May the 4th be with you. Live long and prosper, friends. Hello, everyone, to DM Podcast. I am, as always, with my lovely co-host, Niels.
Hello, guys.
You did not expect that, right?
I did not.
It's not even it's not even May the 4th anymore. It's
no,
May
it isn't. 6th. But think about
it's
it.
Revenge of the 6th.
May the 4th be with you. Revenge of the 5th.
Mm.
And I read something. Shit.
May the 4th, Revenge of the 5th. 6 strikes back.
I don't... Fuck. Mm. I read something just, I think, 30 minutes ago. Ah, oh, shit.
I think we should just say The Empire Strikes Back in Dutch is Dat Imperium knibbelt retour.
Dat Imperium knibbelt retour.
Nee, es knibbelt retour.
Knibbelt,
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 knibbelt, knibbelt. With an eye, knibbelt retour.
Tight, I love that.
It's one of the best movie titles of all time, just because of that.
Definitely, it just made the top 10, the top 5 of my all-time favorite movie titles. Dat Imperium knibbelt retour. Mmm, delicious. All right. So, how are you today? Is everything all right except our, or your and mine weird mental state? Like, you obviously know we are crazy right now. Or
everyone knows that, I hope.
At least if you would listen to one episode, you know we are crazy.
To any episode with an odd number in the with an odd number, you know how weird I am, at least. I mean, last episode, last time I introduced you guys, I became a full-on degenerate.
Yeah.
You gotta love it, I mean, you gotta love it, right?
I mean, you still are, but...
Yeah, obviously.
Yeah.
So, what happened in your week?
Yeah.
What did you do to
nothing,
this week?
Nothing much, actually. Just, I played with my 7 players group again, mm-hmm. and it went bad shit crazy. Shit really hit the fan. And so they were traversing up this mountain because they had a task to find a lost person there. And they were just traversing up the mountainside and heard a rumbling and saw a snowfall. No. English shit. I can't talk.
Do you mean avalanche?
Avalanche, thanks. Yeah, I am brain dead. And had 2 turns to get out of harm's way to save themselves. That's not a lot. And 3 didn't manage to do so. Or 2.5 didn't manage to do so. 2 were buried under the avalanche. And 1 just jumped off the mountainside. He just said, all right, miss me with that shit, and just jumped right off because there was some sort of cliff, and he jumped right down. Luckily, he had featherfall, so he didn't take any damage because we were just slightly below 600 feet up. So it's basically fine. But yeah, finding that person was a lot for the group because it was dark. Nearly nobody had dark vision. And he was alone. So, yeah. You can imagine how that went. And I got a appointment for my COVID-19 vaccination.
Mm. For your
and
first, right?
2.5 weeks already. Yeah.
Not the second dose. Yeah, I'm still a long way from that.
Yeah, I'm just in a different priorization group because I work in food retail. So
you touch my meat.
You bet your ass I touch your meat. Yeah.
I had to say
all from
this.
My
I
part.
Had to say this. I also have a story from my game.
Yeah.
My players reached the big city. I was more or less leading them to for about 2.5 months now. They finally reached that city where they could do whatever they want. It's a big city. It's a big open sandbox. They can play in what they want. The city is in a bit of a turmoil, I would say, because all those that have work in the city are very happy, right? But there's a big group of people that are just without a workspace right now. Because mm-hmm. the city, because the country is not necessarily at war with its neighboring country, but the borders are closed. No trade is happening between the two countries. And this one country only has two real big tradeways. One is a river flowing through that said country they are at war or at whatever with. And, well, if 50% of all your real tradeways go missing or in effect, you have a big problem on your hands because the city has a rather big port for fishers that fish in the big lake that's next to the city, but also very big port for trade across that river until you can reach the sea on the other side of the continent, because the other way is only through a mountain range. There are like 3 to 4 big roads that lead to through that, but they all lead to the same country. So you only have
your trading revenue is shit.
Yeah. Then. So both can. So the country is actually very bad when it comes to trading because it only has really 2 trade partners it can actually trade with, and if they don't, well, they could. The other countries could just not let the cards through or expect tax or something. It's now the riverside is closed, so every dock worker, everyone that works at the docks or works as someone that is involved in shipping stuff to the sea or any other country basically has all cut their profits, all their work in half. So there's a lot of people that if the big trade houses that handle all the trade in the city, those needed to cut 50% of their workers or even more because they couldn't employ them anymore because they are not turning a profit anymore with them in their scheme. It's and my players did not realize this at first. They went through to the town, and there's an outside district of farmers that run the farms. Fields and a lot of different cows, sheep, goats, pigs,
all the
corn,
food provisions
mostly. Those have a big those didn't have a problem at all. They still had to work as normal, so they didn't show any sign of it's actually quite bad right now here in the city. But then my players entered through the wall of through the city gates and were in the district where most of the dock and day-to-day workers live. So they realized there was just as we stepped through this gate, there was a big switch happening. Why is that? And then they went to the docks and realized the docks are empty. All ships just lie at anchor because no one can use them. You can't go anywhere except you have a fishing boat.
Small fisher boats. But that's not really making profit.
No, fishing isn't that's just food provision again. They don't ship the fish they do. They sell it in the city. It's for food. That works, but if you...
But all kind of trade is just...
Trade is gone. Like, concerned... If your biggest profit was through trade that comes through this river, the river is useless now for you. You can't use it. You go bankrupt as a company. And that's why a lot of people are actually quite unhappy in the city. Those simple dock workers were a little bit offensive even to the party because they Because my party only heard the tales of this city is the city of dreams. You can fulfill your dreams here. It's all about hope and being happy and whatnot. But it's actually not. It's a city with its own problems. And now they are feeling those problems. They then went on a long trip to find the best tavern or inn for them. Because they asked one person, which is was an elf, who I cannot talk about. A lot, because my players are listening to this podcast, and there is more to that elf than they think. I think they know that this elf is more than they think, but they don't have yet to expect what actually is with him. They don't.
Yeah, they don't have a clue how deep or in which ways it may lead them.
Yeah.
If they follow up on it, or
yeah, exactly.
What ways
but
he is involved in their story.
But this elf is,
this elf is involved.
Incredibly rich, or at least seems to be. And then they asked him, what tavern do you recommend? Well, I recommend the finest tavern, the most luxurious place here. Yeah, we need something we can afford. Yeah, I don't know. You need to try. And then they more or less split up and searched for a tavern. And it took them, I think, out game nearly 1 hour to actually find the tavern they like. By the way, this is something I would not advise every DM to do like this, because it can get quite boring if the only thing your players do is run around in the city and search for a tavern. But my players quite enjoy this actually, because it gives them time to actually investigate on their own, see the city for themselves. Because I then show them when they walk through the city, I describe the districts they are in. Like, this is a district with a lot of parks. There are a lot of bars on the street. There are big halls where you could maybe hold a concert. There's a theater and all that. And then they realize, okay, this is the arts and craft district. Here are a lot of musicians, a lot of artists and all. Okay, this, then they get into something, into more or less the slums of the city. Okay. This is dirty, it's cheap here and all that. So they learn a little bit about the city, and they enjoy that, because now, next session, which is in a week, when this episode comes out, then they can more or less do what they want. My brain, however, decided after they have all gone to sleep, why don't you put this session on a cliffhanger? Because my brain thinks, even though I know it's totally fine to not end your session on a cliffhanger for your players, they will come back to the table anyway, at least most of the time, but
yeah,
I thought, let's make it a cliffhanger so I can drive them a bit to do something. Because I told them, you need to do, you have a lot of options here. I won't tell you which, but you need to do something. And then I was like, okay, yeah, you have this dream. And something creeps into your dreams. Something pierces through the veil of your dreams and sits and plants itself in your dreams. Something dark, something sinister, something more that you didn't expect to come into your dreams. And you sit there and you try to concentrate to push it back, but still resisting. It's stronger than you. You can't fight back. So the only thing you can is just listen to the voice you hear in your head.
Then I have one question for you.
Yeah.
Do you yet know, or do you know already what this kind of entity is?
No.
Or did you know at this time when you said it?
No, at the time I said it, I didn't know who would be talking or what they were saying. I know now. I have finally figured that out after a day or two of thinking.
If you wouldn't have, you just fucked yourself, mate.
Yeah, it's okay. It's okay. Also, I want to say I'm really happy that International Championship League of Legends is starting again, because I missed that quite a lot, viewing League of Legends teams compete around the world against each other. That was
Just it's great interaction between the teams and
yeah.
seeing how different playstyles clash.
I have something to distract myself from other things, from work or something. So it's good. It's fine. It's a little bit. It's honest work. Like no, I like it quite a lot.
Yeah.
Nothing big to touch on.
Distracting yourself from every chore you have to do, like doing the dishes, taking out trash, doing your homework, stuff like that.
Yeah, and just seeing some good fucking esport League of Legends is something I actually quite enjoy. We also, very important, hit 100,000 followers. No, 100,000, that would be amazing.
100,000, oh boy!
1,000, obviously, followers.
Would I have missed that page? Damn.
We have made 1,000 followers on Twitter, and as we promised, we will hold a giveaway in the next couple of weeks. We need still to figure out some stuff about this. But I think we will have that ready in a week or two for you guys. Don't worry, it's not Twitter only. You will also be able to participate on Instagram and probably every other social media, which is no other social media we have. Yeah. If you count Discord, you can count Discord. Maybe people in our Discord will get an extra entry. I don't know. We also cracked 250 listens, which is quite cool.
Yeah, just the last week we had 65 listens. I mean, I didn't expect any of this.
No.
The last week just blew up, I guess, or something
like that. We expected, we have 200, we have like 500 listens at the end of the year if we pull this till the end of the year. We are already at half of that after just 2.5 months of doing this.
It's just, damn. Yeah, yes, it's just a lot. It's overwhelming, actually.
Yeah, we should probably get into our topic today because we have an amazing guest with us. John Hodgson is from Handiwork Games and will be with us shortly talking to us about the upcoming 5th edition supplement Beowulf Age of Heroes, which is supplement adapted for duet play, so one GM and one player, like games like Iron Sworn are known for, but in D&D. And it's about the Beowulf poem or the Beowulf mystical saga, and you can now more or less play that in your 5e games with this supplement. I think we should.
We talk about a lot more, actually.
Yeah.
We have something like how to start a creative process and stuff like that. It's all planned. It's an amazing episode, I hope.
Yeah, John talks a lot about creative, also about inspiration and how to start a creative process, what is important to look out for, and gives a lot of advice on what to actually do with the stuff you do.
Yeah, it was an amazing interview. I had a lot of fun with it.
So
we'll be on a short break and be with you shortly.
Yeah.
Hello and welcome back. So, we are with our guest today, John Hodgins. So, would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure, hello.
Who are you? What did you do? How did you get into TTRPGs? This kind of stuff.
Hello, yeah, thanks for having me on the show. My name's John Hodgson. So, at the moment, I run a indie press called Handiwork Games. We make a bunch of different stuff, but our main thing on the go at the moment is Beowulf Age of Heroes, which is a 5th edition adaptation for one GM and one player. Prior to running Handiwork Games, I spent almost a decade working for a company called Cubicle 7, where I was the creative director for a good few years. And before that, I was the art director and kind of lead artist. And we made the One Ring role-playing game, 1st edition. Also, during that time, I was freelancing as well. So I've worked on Dungeons & Dragons, making artwork for that, a whole bunch of other games, Glorantha. I did a load of covers for Glorantha, for Chaosium, and their previous incarnation as Moon Design. What else have I done? Loads of different things. Beyond the Wall, that's another bit of a fan favourite. I did the covers and a lot of interior art for that. And even going back further than that, I worked for many years for Warhammer Historical, which is a kind of obscure offshoot of the Games Workshop property. Had a lot of fun working on that. So yeah, and how did I get into tabletop role-playing games? Same way as a lot of other people, I think. in the UK in that I started with the fighting fantasy game books, you know, just solo player, choose your own adventure, and then graduated through the school book club onto a game called Dragon Warriors, which was a full RPG that came in small paperback books that you collected. There were a bunch of them to build up the full system and setting. Absolutely loved those as a kid, and then moved on from there to everything you'd expect, D&D and so on. So yeah, years and years of role playing, which I still love very much. Yeah,
sounds like an awesome journey already.
It was all right, kept me out of trouble mostly.
But those are some very big names on your portfolio. Chaosium,
oh, yeah.
The One Ring, Cubicle 7, and D&D even. So
yeah,
you've already done quite a lot.
Yeah, I've been very lucky. I've worked for loads and loads of different people. I mean, I've been doing this quite a long time now. I'm shockingly old now. So when did I go full-time as an illustrator? That was around 2000, 2001. Pathfinder as well. I worked a lot on that. Which was great. Learned an enormous amount working on Pathfinder, actually, from Sarah Robinson, who's the art director there. She's always been someone I've looked up to as an art director. So yeah, lots and lots of different things.
And when you said 2001 and 2000, I was like, yep, I was 2 years old at this at that point.
Yeah,
not to make you feel old, but
yeah, I'm fantastically old. See, 2000, I still feel like it was about 10 years ago. But yeah.
Yeah, it kind of feels the same though.
Mm.
I can't really. It's how fast the time is flying by. It's just insane.
Yeah, oh, certainly. I mean,
not gonna lie,
the last couple of years have just been a very strange limbo. What was I reading the other day on the internet that when people say last year, they mean 2019. You know, because last year just didn't happen.
The single fact that. If you now look at an ID in the US and you see a 1 at the beginning, the person is instantly eligible to buy alcohol is so actually still surreal for so surreal for me, because if you've been born before the year 2000, you're automatically 21 already. And
wow,
it's so weird actually.
Yeah,
time moves so fast. It's so weird.
I mean, I was born in 1998, but it still feels like people born after 2000, they are still 5 years old or something like that. It just feels like it. It's a weird thing.
Gosh, so I was born in the 70s. Can you believe it? And the first half of the 70s at that. Brilliant. Great. I'm so old.
With age comes experience.
Well, apparently, so they tell me. And I'll tell you something funny that does occur. The other day, somebody had very kindly put on Twitter, I'm not exactly sure what this was in connection with, but they put together a bunch of images of paintings from artists they liked, and they were all dragons. And it was some very complimentary company that I was in, and I can't remember the full list, so I'm not even going to begin to name anyone. But there was a picture that I had painted that when I saw it, I remembered that I had painted this dragon. I don't really remember very much about it in a slightly worrying way, where you go, oh yeah, that was that Facebook game when Facebook games were really big. I mean, we're talking at least 10, 12 years ago. Facebook games were seeing quite a lot of money being spent on their sort of development. And I spent 6 months working on a Facebook game and I made loads of artwork, but I haven't thought about that for a very long time. And that's kind of weird, where you go, wow, like, I never thought that would happen. But yeah, it does.
Well, I've looked at your art and I can definitely tell you it's good. It's very good.
Thank you very much. That's very kind of you. I do my best.
Well, it's better than anything I would ever actually be able to do with my hand. I have two left hands. When it comes to anything that you could call artistic.
Okay, yep.
I'm a programmer by trade. I program systems at work, but when it comes to being creative, I sometimes hit a block. Sometimes creative process is actually very hard for me.
Okay.
Yeah. So, If there's nothing else now, I would like to move on to the German lyric game that our... it's gone. I will still just continue.
Sure.
He will probably be back with us. So we have prepared three German song lyrics for you.
Okay.
I'm just gonna read them and you can answer with anything you like. If you want to translate them with a joke, whatever. So the first song lyric is Atemlos durch die Nacht, bis ein neuer Tag erwacht.
See, would now be a bad time to reveal I did study German at school, but that was a very long time ago. Okay, no, you've got me stumped there. I'm not sure. I like the rhyme of it, but I'm not sure. I don't have a clue what that would mean. Can I tell a funny story instead about learning German at school?
Obviously. So,
when we were at school, we learned how to say, and I'll probably mangle this because we are going back like 30 years or something. And one of the few phrases that I remember that we were taught, which seemed absolutely ridiculous, was "Wie komme ich am besten zum Frühstückzimmer, bitte?" And I thought, when are we ever going to need to ask, how do I get to like the breakfast room? This seemed an absolutely stupid thing to learn. But then, not that long ago, 5 years ago, I was in Essen at Spiel.
Mm-hmm.
And I needed to ask how to get to the breakfast room. And I felt really bad because I had laughed at my school so hard teaching us this apparently useless vocabulary. And I used it and I felt I needed to sort of write a letter of apology to my German teacher. So, yeah. But anyway, that was not answering the question, the quiz question at all.
It was still a fun story, so I let it count. Okay. The song lyric is from a song by Helene Fischer, which is a German... It's a weird German type of music, genre of music.
I think it would be called folk music.
Okay.
Yeah.
German folk music,
But 2000 folk music.
Okay.
Yeah.
Folk music from the 2000s.
Yeah, that's
the evolved stage.
That would count as folk music, I think. Yeah.
We would count that. The translation would be breathless through the night until the next day awakes or begins, something along the lines of that.
Okay. Nacht I caught, but that was it. Wow.
The next one will be Ich wär so gerne Millionär, dann wär mein Konto niemals leer.
I'm pretty sure that's because she's been in news recently, so that'll be Jennifer Lopez saying how she is still Jenny from the Block, surely.
I will let that count as well. Yes, obviously. That's correct.
Yep. Yes, thank you. Right, moving on. I'll just sort of bull my way through there. Yeah,
perfect.
Yeah.
It's from a German band called Prinzen. So Prince.
Okay.
The Princess. The song is called Millionaire and is the song lyric is I would love to be a millionaire, then my bank account would never be empty.
Great. Well, that's quite good. Yeah.
That's a song I haven't heard in a long time.
Yeah, same here.
Okay. Oh, man.
And the last one is Ich dekoriere besoffene Freunde. Ist zwar gemein, aber leider geil.
Oh, man.
This is a bit beyond very, very basic German vocabulary. There was something about friends in there, so I think it probably wasn't. Now I've said that so confidently. I'm trying to think of an amusing song with the word friends in. Yeah, it's the theme tune from the show Friends, which they changed for the German show to include the word friends so that it made more sense. I'll be friends with you, they changed it to in the German.
Oh, my God. I would love this song. Oh, my God. Every
this
German
would be
now.
Perfect. Yes.
Either now just staring, huh? What is this show Friends called? And if they are, please watch Friends. But This is actually the best answer we have ever gotten for this already.
Yeah, no doubt about it.
The lyric would translate to, I decorate drunk friends is mean, but unfortunately, and now the word geil, it has no real translation to English, so it's either hot, nice, cool, sexy, whatever you want to pick from
right,
that.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, okay. Wow. There we go. That would be great.
It's a very weird German song. It would fit not at all over the Friends intro, but I kind of want to see it now.
Yeah. It would. What? How much would that improve the show? It would be brilliant. They should have a German character in the show who draws on them when they're drunk. You know, that would be great. That would really improve it. They could just come in, they could CGI it in. Jennifer Aniston comes in just with, you know, pen marks all over her face. But she wouldn't react, you know.
On her cheek.
Yeah, she wouldn't know, you see. So no, there wouldn't be no need to re-record it or anything. But, yeah.
I would love that. I would so much love that. Well, I would love to continue this
song.
Yeah, Niels?
The song actually had a really big boom when it came out, and it was... 2012, just to get on the nostalgia train again.
Wow.
It was
don't start me.
So basically yesterday, but 10 years ago.
Yeah.
So
goodness me.
Okay. Well, I would love to keep going with German song names. I think we should actually also talk about your work with Beowulf and Handiwork Games. So you're the creator of Beowulf and a lot of other things?
Yeah, co-creator of Beowulf.
Co-creator,
definitely.
Okay.
Yeah.
What can you tell us about your work at Handiwork Press? How does your usual day look like?
Okay, so we're a pretty loose organization. We do, unusually for role-playing game companies, we do have... How many of us are there in total? Four of us are actually employed full time at the company, which is not very normal. When I set the company up a couple of years ago, I went that route, which was somewhat strange. Normally, role playing games companies really rely on a lot of freelancers, whereas I wanted to give the guys who came to the company a little bit more security than that. So it's, I mean, it causes me no end of problems, but you know, it's good. It's the right thing to do, I think. Normally I am the boss of the company. I am in charge of what we do and you know, what projects we do and I have the final say on pretty much everything we put out. So my day to day begins. Normally I'm a dad, I've got a couple of kids. So I'm normally up fairly early in the day. I'm normally up and about by about 7. Of course, anyone who's a real early riser will be laughing at the thought of that being early, but that's about when I'm up and around. And then there's sort of domestic stuff until I go for a walk just around 9 o'clock, just to sort of clear my head and get my thoughts together for the day, get a bit of exercise because there's an awful lot of just sitting around. Not being particularly physically active while doing other things, so I like to get my exercise in, and then I have a home office at the bottom of our garden, which is a really lovely space. We've recently moved into there, which is brilliant. It's a nice big, it's kind of 7 meters by 3 meters with a great big window, big folding door, which is lovely. So I settle in there with a cup of coffee and work through till about 6 o'clock, and my day will involve, all kinds of things: commissioning artwork, briefing artwork, doing writing and design, lots of meetings. We do. I'll have a sort of daily chat with Danny, who you've spoken to, who is our marketing person. She's very good at all that stuff, which is great. We're very lucky actually to have Danny on board. She's got a tremendous amount of experience with social media and marketing and promotions. She comes online around midday. So there's always a lot just before midday. So there's always a lot of chat there about what we're going to be showing off on a given day and what we've got coming up to show off. And then it's a mix of making artwork, writing, editing, supervising layout, chasing clients. Because at Handiwork Games, we make our own games. We also do a lot of work for other games companies on a kind of studio basis. So we usually have some work on the go for somebody else that will need some kind of attention in one way or another. I work Monday to Friday, those kind of hours. I try and keep a bit of family time in the mix if I can. That's about an average day, I think.
That sounds, especially with probably your view from your home office, also can get a lot of relaxation just by looking outside the window. Because if I look outside my window right now, I see construction work.
Do you know what? We're two things there. Number one, my office faces the wrong way. My office faces south. If it faced north, and I could see through a fence and a house, I'd have a tremendous view of the Plain of Stirling and the Ochil Hills, because I'm in Scotland. We have an absolutely amazing view from our house, but not from my office. I was thinking putting put a periscope in or something that I can, like a submarine as, so I can sort of look at the view. But I thought maybe the neighbours would find that a bit weird that I was spying on them through periscope. And also, to the other thing, talking of construction, we just remodeled our house over the last 6 months, and it's just been a complete construction site for a really long time, so you have my sympathy for your own construction view. Goodness me. I mean, it's definitely really good to have a dedicated workspace. Is this huge advantage,
I have my workspace here. I'm sitting at it. Obviously, I have some TTRPG dice right next to me, but I also have a lot of work and things I need for the day job I have here. And it's always good to have a clean workspace and also some sort of balance at the workspace. So left, I have the TTRPG stuff. So if I ever get frustrated, I can just roll some dice and get frustrated at them and then throw them in the dice jail, and then I can get back to work. You would say a good workspace is already something you should have if you have a lot of work.
Right. I mean, and when I started out, my workspace really was just a drawing board on my knee. I started out as a freelance illustrator, and just having a board to put my work on. But even that was it was important to sort of have a place where I set that up and worked, so you can concentrate and get into the work frame of mind, I think. Very useful.
Actually, regarding that, you created or co-created BioWolf, among others. And so how does one actually start the creative process of making a TTRPG setting or a rulebook like BioWolf, for example?
Yeah, that was... This is quite a hard one to remember the exact sort of setup for BioWolf. So we started out... There's a team of us who did the initial writing and design for BioWolf. So that was myself, Jacob Rogers, and David Rea, who they were both people I had worked with on The One Ring. Jacob had particularly done a lot of stuff. We did a 5th edition adaptation of The One Ring called Adventures in Middle-earth. And Jacob had done a lot of the conversion work of the adventures. And I really like how Jacob thinks and how he works, so it was an absolute no-brainer to work with him. David had done a lot of proofreading on Adventures in Middle-earth and The One Ring, and again, I like how David thinks. David plays role-playing games in a very different style to myself, and a different style again to Jacob, and he's really useful to have around. He's very incisive and kind of thoughtful about criticisms and how games work in play and stuff. David's really useful to have around. And the three of us put our heads together. I just started Handiwork Games, and we were planning what projects we would like to make. Now, what we did there, to actually get to the point of answering your question, was we looked at what we were interested in, which I think is really, really important, what we felt we could do well, and what resources we had available to us, because there were decisions like, did we want to make like a 5th edition thing, sort of piggybacking on the back of 5th edition, or did we want to make an entirely new role-playing game? We could have done that, but we decided to make the adaptation because we felt it was achievable for us in a shorter space of time. Hilariously, now looking at it, we thought we would have Beowulf done in about 6 months. It took 2 years in the end, but the final project is way more. There's so much more to it than we initially set out to do, and that evolved quite organically. But the starting point was very much looking at what we felt we could achieve with what we had to hand and the people we had or the people we could bring on board. And Beowulf, I mean, I'm through all the work I've done on both historical war game stuff and the Tolkien games, I'm really interested in that, what people commonly call the Dark Ages, the sort of migration era, early medieval era. And I've got a fair amount of knowledge about that. We did lots and lots of research for Beowulf on top of that, but my sort of basic grounding in that era was solid to sort of begin a project. But I think the most important part is doing something that you really care about and that you're really passionately interested in, so that when inevitably it gets difficult, you've got that love of the subject to fall back on and keep you going, which hopefully does keep you going. Yeah.
Okay. So my next question would be, you've talked a lot about Beowulf, Age of Heroes, but and also said it's adapted for duet play. But tell us a little bit more about what is this rulebook setting actually?
The game is primarily aimed at games of 5th edition for one player and one GM. So as the player, you take the role of a hero in the mold of Beowulf. So Beowulf is one of the oldest pieces of recorded literature in the kind of Western canon, if you like. It's an epic poem written by the historical Anglo-Saxons who colonized the British Isles around 500 AD, around the middle of the first millennium. And it's a real adventure story, Beowulf. A lot of people were forced to study it, say, at college or at school, and didn't really find the love of it in terms of it being a pure adventure story, a fantasy adventure story, but it's all there. Beowulf, the titular hero, sails to Denmark. He's from southern Sweden. Sails to Denmark because he hears there's a mead hall in trouble, basically being haunted by a monster called Grendel. So he decides, being a hero, he'll set off there and sort their problems out for them. And the poem recounts his adventures. I mean, even though it's 1500 years old at this point, I don't want to give any spoilers for anyone who hasn't read it. And I mean, it also involves, there's a dragon in there, there's various monsters and mentions of various monsters. And from this, we developed this setting for 5th edition that is based in early Europe. It's really the sort of Beowulf, the poem, is thought to have been written down around 1000 CE. But it remembers an earlier time. It remembers the time before the historical Anglo-Saxons came to the British Isles. It remembers when they were still in sort of northern central Europe, in Denmark and Sweden and so on, and northern Germany. It's this weird ancestor time, and our adventures take place in that. And so we give you all the details for that kind of setting, along with one of the key things about Beowulf is we give you permission that you don't need to know the history as such. This is like a storybook world of heroic tales. So you don't need to be, it's nothing to do with being historically accurate. All our sources for material are generally based in history and quite historically accurate, although we throw a fairly wide net in what we draw on. It's not one specific, 20-year period of history. We draw on probably 500 years of arms and armor from that time and folklore and so on. We give you that setting, lots of information on what people think, what they do, what the place is like. For example, there are no towns, really. There are halls that are ruled by a king or a queen or a lord of some kind. And around them, there are settlements that have grown up. But this is really pre-towns. It's still a gift-giving economy. And yeah, very much the sort of world of the mythic world of the historical Anglo-Saxons. Oh, so probably worth mentioning, I keep saying historical Anglo-Saxons because there is a current kind of controversy in the historical study world that where there is a move to retire the term Anglo-Saxon because it is being misused by people who use it, it for later periods to describe what we commonly call white people. Clearly, our game has nothing to do with that. It is about a group of people from Denmark, Northern Germany, who are referred to traditionally as the Anglo-Saxons. But this is nothing to do with white people, for want of a better term. So yeah, that's that. What else is in there? So we also give you a whole bunch of 5th edition rules stuff. We have the hero class and 6 subclasses. And the hero class is a little bit more high-powered than the core 5e classes because it is intended to be played without a party. We also have, to help with that, we have some rules, pieces of rules technology we've developed, such as followers, that are a little bit different to traditionally in Dungeons & Dragons. You'd have things like hirelings or sidekicks. We use followers for heroes. Every hero has a band of followers, and they work something a little bit like spells, where each follower has a number of quite mechanically simple abilities, and they can be triggered usually once a day. I mean, there's various, you know, obviously, as you can imagine, there are various different rules for how often a follower can sort of be invoked, as it were. They come into the spotlight, they do their thing, and then they retreat back into the spotlight. So they don't take too much management. They don't have a great big character sheet or anything like that. They are a name and a little list of what we call tags, which are gifts and burdens. So sometimes followers are not always purely beneficial. Sometimes they come at a cost. And that can have an impact on your adventures. What else do we have? And oh, ships. Every hero has a ship. We give you lots of details of equipment appropriate to the settings. All the weapons and armor have been tweaked from the 5e rules to be appropriate for a kind of historical Anglo-Saxon campaign, mythic campaign. So no plate armor. All the shields are round. Helms and shields and so on are a little bit more powerful than they are in standard 5th edition, just so that you can kit out your hero in an era appropriate costume but gain the benefits of the better armor at the top end of 5e and stuff like that. What else is in the book? There's an adventure, beginning adventure. Hopefully, if you're interested in Beowulf, you'll have already picked up and played a free PDF we put out called The Hermit Sanctuary. And that's totally free. It's a full adventure for Beowulf, so you can grab that, and that will give you a really good idea of what it's all about. I feel like I've spoken for a really long time there.
So, please don't. It's totally fine. This episode is about you and your work, not about us.
Yeah, there's an awful lot in that Beowulf book, let me tell you. There's a lot there. Hopefully all good, interesting stuff. So, oh, there's an enormous bestiary of monsters. All sort of folklore and historical stuff. So yeah, that's definitely worth taking a look at.
Sounds like a lot.
There is a lot there. How many pages is it now? 200 and something. I've got the print proofs here. We're expecting the print books will arrive in our friend's warehouse in Germany probably tomorrow, terrifyingly enough. I'm looking for my print proof so I can accurately check the page count. Hang on, let me grab them. They're just on a desk behind me. Yeah, that's right, I've got them here. So I don't want to name the wrong page count. Yeah, 270 pages. So yeah, it's a nice size of hardback book.
Nice.
I'm definitely intrigued.
I am too.
Grab The Hermit Sanctuary because it's totally free. It's a full adventure. It's like full length. I mean, that's like...
I will grab that myself once we are finished recording.
Cool.
And then,
it's worth a look because it shows you, it's pretty much all the rules. There's a few little minor variations in the main book compared to the Hermit Sanctuary. The Hermit Sanctuary is meant to be nice and simple, so you can just get your head around it very quickly. But yeah, it's all there and it's free, so that's always nice, right? Cool.
You already mentioned the hero class, obviously. with 6 subclasses. And if I read correctly on your website, it says that those 6 subclasses are more or less around the 6 ability scores. So that's one right. subclass for each, because it's duet play, right? You have to somewhat adapt to only having one. You only having one character in the game, because normally you have some sort of party composition with someone that can soak a lot of hits, someone that can deal some sort of high damage, and someone who can heal or something. But with this, how do these subclasses really look? How does the hero class work?
So you've got, at a very basic level, you get things like a few more hit points and so on, just to give so that a hero can cope with the kind of damage economy that goes on in 5e. Obviously, if they had just regular levels of hit points, they wouldn't really last very long. Now, in terms of the subclasses each being based on an ability score, an interesting aspect of Beowulf is that really sets the kind of the tone for your hero, if you like. So if you're, say, an intelligence based hero, so that would be the riddle reaver is the name for the subclass there, you're much more of an investigative, thoughtful kind of hero who maybe, if you wanted to pick an analog from a different set of myths, like Odysseus, let's say, out of the Trojan War, who uses a bit of cleverness and isn't just about brute strength. Now, the great thing is, you're not because they're all subclasses. When it comes to things like feats, you can pick stuff that is not necessarily just purely intelligence based. So you can build some really interesting, quite different builds by layering up those choices that you would normally make from quite a limited palette. You obviously have access to the whole hero class. So you've got a lot of opportunities to build quite flexible characters, and then you need to be to a certain degree. Now, the other thing where to enable the duet play and enable the heroes to work and be able to have adventures, we use quite a particular structure to adventures in Beowulf. It's hopefully not you can build off this into different kinds of adventures to suit your player, which we absolutely recommend you do. You know, have a solid session zero with your player and decide what kind of things you would like to do in your campaign. But in general, Beowulf campaigns are about traveling to a place, finding out what the problem is that the place has got, and then solving it. Now, that might well be, I mean, every time the problem is almost always going to be a monster. Now, the monsters vary hugely, so the actual kind of problem will vary in as much as monsters vary. It may be something that doesn't just require brute strength and combat. It may require sort of intelligence and riddling and so on, a great plan to overcome the monster or find its weakness. There's a lot of what heroes do in Beowulf Age of Heroes is uncovering the weakness of a monster to learn how to defeat it. So that kind of structure really helps with the lack of a full party of, like you say, that sort of niche protection thing of a healer and a tank and a, you know, to dip into video game terminology. Mm-hmm. But you know what I mean, you know, those different niches of things. The structure of adventures really helps with that.
We were talking this in one of our last, no, actually our last episode, that one was about combat, where we were very big on the thing that combat isn't just about hitting, and rather about solving some sort of problem. The problem being a monster, but that you can also beat that monster through baiting it into a trap, it into a pit, where it dies from the fall or something. So, like you said, this it isn't always about hitting or brute strength. It's also about thinking and solving the problem the best way to the hero's ability.
Yeah, I mean, I think any really good GM is going to provide a lot of opportunities to beat an encounter in different ways, right? Something we also have in Beowulf Age of Heroes that we introduce is something called the defeated condition. Because we only have the one hero, and because of the kind of setting it is and the kind of things we read in the epic poems and so on of the day, we didn't want heroes to be solely focused on reducing monsters to zero hit points, or particularly if they meet and fight other human beings, we didn't want them to be just riding around the Baltic slaughtering people, because that, if they do that, that makes them a certain kind of character, a certain kind of hero in inverted commas. So what the defeated condition does is, once every creature has or monster, at least let's talk about monsters, every monster has a set of potential criteria under which, when they come to pass, that creature is defeated. And a defeated creature, we give the GM a bunch of options for how that will manifest itself. So it may be they just flee. It may be that they become completely open to suggestion and orders given by the hero. Because I really like the idea of, say, you know, a nasty big troll is plaguing an area and the hero beats on it for a while, but it gets to a certain point where the troll then becomes suggestible, if you know what I mean. You can order it to leave and never come back, and that happens, because a very important part of the defeated condition is it is always genuine and in good faith. Monsters aren't able to sort of trick you that they're defeated. If they gain the defeated condition, they are defeated. And it also covers things like dropping rocks on creatures, you know, pulling the roof in. I was about to give a spoiler there, if I won't do that, for one of our adventures. And yeah, I think it's really important. And that is hardwired into Beowulf, that there are ways to overcome creatures and defeat them without reducing them to zero hit points. Much as, and to be fair to fifth edition, there is the suggestion that hit points don't necessarily reflect, you know, you're not dead at zero hit points necessarily, you are beaten. But we wanted to take that a step further, that there are conditions you can inflict on monsters where they stop fighting and you've won, but without reducing them to zero hit points.
Okay, that sounds actually quite interesting. I will have to check that out once I get my hands on the book.
And it sounds like a lot of planning to do. And I'm sure you went through a lot of draft versions of law, rules, and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Is there something you guys scrapped because it was just too ridiculous in what sense soever, or?
Yeah, definitely. Several different things. The one that comes to mind was, we really wanted to, in the poem of Beowulf, you have this tension between the sort of pagan or heathen ways and the sort of newer religion of Christianity. And we thought long and hard about how we were going to use that in our game. And we didn't want to ignore it, because, and especially it's interesting, particularly for an American market, where a lot of our customers are in America. I think there's quite a different attitude to religion than you might find in European countries. And we had to be mindful of that. Luckily, Jacob and David are both based in America, so they could provide really good insights into that. But I felt very strongly we needed to include Christianity. Now, how we chose to do that in the end was to use alignment. So as the hero class has a choice of three different alignments, which are the old ways, which is sort of heathenry, if you like, Christianity, which we call the Church of the Book, which, so just to put a little remove, it is meant to be Christianity, but we call it the Church more than we call it Christianity. Just to give you a little bit of space there, that this is a storybook world. It was very interesting doing all the necessary research about the early church is very, very different to the contemporary church. And again, particularly in America and so on, very different organizations at work. So anyway, we use alignment. Now, we wanted that to have a mechanical effect as well with alignment. So we wanted to bring in this idea of an alignment dice that somehow. So the old ways is kind of, we reference Tolkien's essay around Beowulf, where he talks about the old ways, a sort of pagan Northern European outlook of a sort of doomed world. The world is doomed to be devoured by monsters, and the best you can hope for is a good death. So we wanted it that when a hero of the old ways suffers some sort of defeat, they would gain inspiration. So we wanted, originally, we came up with these really big tables that, depending on what you rolled, would give you something or take something away. And they were kind of flipped for Christianity and the old ways, so that Christians were inspired by hope and so on and good fortune. And old ways heroes got sort of tougher the more you beat them down, this kind of thing we were trying to work around. And at one point we had a system that sort of worked, but it was so complicated. it was a hard, you know, I don't know if you guys have heard the phrase of kill your darlings, and it was a hard darling to kill, but it didn't work at the table. It worked sort of intellectually, but it just didn't work as a system for play. And, you know, if there's one thing that's really great about fifth edition is it is that it's quite streamlined, it's quite quick to play, you know, they file down a lot of the edges from older editions of that game, you know, it's nice and streamlined. And we realized we were introducing something that was just the opposite of that. So that had to go, and I was quite sorry to see it go, because it still feels a little bit like there's something in there that was good. But Jacob actually developed a system for the alignment dice, where when you have advantage, your second dice is your alignment dice. It is sort of tied to your faith. And if you choose that dice as the result of your roll, then you gain inspiration, whether you've won or lost. And that covers it very neatly. It's a beautiful little piece of games design that doesn't wreck fifth edition like the charts we were using did. We were also looking at trying to put symbols onto dice, you know, the faces of a d20. Mm-hmm. But there's not a lot of room on a d20. So yeah, that had to go. So yeah, and definitely I can't think of anything else that I can talk about in detail that we got rid of. But goodness me, we went through a lot of followers in particular, getting them to work. They're very simple actually in play, but that sort of hides an enormous amount of work and an enormous number of failed attempts to get that bit right. Yeah, and it's, I think, so much about good design is putting that time in, isn't it, to work at it until it's right, even if you're fed up of it, you know, or you're frustrated.
Yes, I know that feeling.
But if it's a project of art, you're not that, if you see the end product and it works, it kind of is worth the time you put into it.
Yeah, yeah. The pain is temporary, you know, and a beautifully crafted book is forever. So, yeah, definitely. It's worth it. It's always worth it, you know.
And regarding the time you put into changing the rules to work like you want them to work, you said Beowulf is adapted for do-it play.
Mm.
How did this fact change the design process for adapting it to 5e?
I think one of the big things we had to deal with that's quite, trying to think how to put this, it's quite to the forefront of fifth edition play, is that action economy of, you know, everyone's turn and how that plays out and what they can do. And fifth edition is really good for this with, you know, actions, bonus actions, reactions. Making sure that one player could do enough on their turn that they had meaningful choices and could win, you know, could win in combats, and so on. And that was all linked into a whole bunch of other systems within the game. So, I mean, followers first and foremost. One of the primary uses of followers in the game is that they can use an ability called Engage, where they kind of lock down other opponents that perhaps the hero is not fighting at that moment. They keep them locked up. I'm imagining, we always talk about this, old Robin Hood movies, or, you know, I'm not sure if there's a German equivalent of those kind of vintage movies, where in the background you see extras kind of clashing swords, and they're not, you know, the plot is that they are not advancing the plot, but they are keeping the baddies busy, you know, so that Robin Hood can swing from the light fittings. And we very much, that's very much how we see followers. They can keep opponents busy until the hero is ready to get to them. And that works really nicely. I mean, it's not necessarily automatic, and followers can die and so on. There's a lot more, obviously there's more detail in the main rules. But yeah, that was, you know, tricky to implement.
Mm-hmm. So you basically give the hero or the player I don't want to say expendable resources because people are not expendable resources.
Yeah.
But they are somewhat also of a resource you need to manage, you need to work with, and probably also if you have a ship, like you said, you can call those followers or also probably a crew on that ship.
Yeah, you do. We draw a difference between the crew and your band of followers, but there is movement between the two. Should Horror of Horror, the hero, find that all their followers have been killed on an adventure, you can sort of promote members of the crew to become followers. They start as very basic followers. But what we also wanted to do was make sure that this came out during development, that make sure that the crew are really the engine of the ship. And we wanted to have the hero very mobile in sort of the North Sea, the Baltic Sea, which we could, the two seas we termed the Whale Road. We wanted them to be able to get between the kingdom of the weak, you know, and the next kingdom where there was a problem. And so they needed a ship, and they needed it. We didn't want to get into too much simulation of how a ship functions. We really wanted them to have a crew who don't take part in fighting and so on. That differentiation exists. But yes, you can. That's a whole sideline. But yeah, you can recruit from those guys. Sorry, go on.
What I was talking about more, that you have these NPCs that work with you, so you also have more or less a cast of crew members or followers that you as a player engage with in role play. Obviously, you make friends with those, you have more or less relationships to those followers, because you don't have a party composition, you don't have more or less other players at the table that can interact with your player character.
Yeah, and I mean, a really interesting thing, and you never know when you put something like this together how it's going to be received and how people will play it, because we were a little bit worried that we didn't want followers to be totally expendable. And very early on in the first playtest, we heard back from a few GMs whose players were using followers in a very, it was only one particular group, but they were using followers in a way we found a bit like, this is not the intention, and we worked on things a little bit more. Now we have a Discord and a community and so on. Obviously we had, you know, there's like 1,000 backers for Beowulf, so we have a really nice group of people all playing the game right now, and people are really attached to their followers. And one of my favorite groups that are playing, I don't know these people other than through Beowulf, but their followers are like having romances and stuff, which are almost undermined by their need to go on adventures with the hero and sometimes put their lives in danger for the hero. And as you say, as a sort of, you know, it's awful to talk about sort of characters that are human beings, but non-player characters, you know, they are expected to be a little bit less durable perhaps than the hero. But people have put this enormous amount of time into them, develop them as characters. You can progress your followers. We have downtime journaling where the player writes up the adventures of their followers to improve their followers so they can gain more abilities through what you decide they're doing between the main adventures, which is really cool. And people have really invested in their followers, which I'm just absolutely delighted about, because we didn't want them to be... We wanted them to be like Wiglaf from the Beowulf poem, you know, honorable shield bearers who the hero loves, you know, and mourns their loss and so on, should they, you know, die in their service. And yeah, that's, we're seeing that, and it's marvelous. It's really lovely. Which when we started, that seemed like quite a lofty aim to achieve. You know, you couldn't just sit down with a blank piece of paper and go, right, I want to make players care about NPCs that they run, and also, you know, who are really sort of like a bag of spare hit points for them. Yeah, but it's, we got there, which is great. I'm loving it.
Yeah. Sounds awesome for me. For people that might want to try their hand themselves on writing such another setting or rule book for 5th edition or any kind of other rule book or even their own rule book in general, what would you say are big do's and big don'ts for that?
Okay, I would say the primary thing that, I suppose... We do consultancy for other publishers and so on, because we've got a lot of experience between us. And when someone is new to this, my first piece of advice always is just start small. Start on something with a limited scope that you can see a beginning, middle and end to the project itself. So it might be as simple as, for example, this is tricky when we're talking about, say, making a new game or a whole setting and so on. But, you know, write up a monster from beginning to end, or write up a location or something from beginning to end, so that you've been through the whole thing and you can achieve something quite readily that isn't going to be this enormous sort of burden to complete and almost an impossible task. You know, give yourself something that you can complete. Again, I talk to a lot of people around Kickstarter, and it's so much better to get some experience doing just a small project that isn't a whole game. You know, whole games are really tricky things to do. You know, it's an enormous amount of work. Whereas if you can just do a small part of a game, you know, and present it to people in a way that they can buy into or support you, or, you know, you may not be doing this for money. You may just want people to play something you've written, but keep it small. You know, start with an adventure or an encounter or a creature, just something that isn't gonna make you feel desperately depressed when you don't finish it. It's like, write a short story, not a novel. You know, and short stories are very difficult as well. You know, they have their own difficulties, but it's more readily achievable than, you know, a trilogy with a movie tie-in and action figures. You know, just try and do something achievable and within your means. And again, this is where we started with Beowulf. Like, what can we do? You know, what do we think we can readily achieve, rather than, you know, shooting for the moon and failing and then feeling awful. So yeah, that's probably my biggest piece of advice. Yeah, it's just do something small that you can get under your belt and is a finished piece of work that you can be proud of to a degree. And as soon as you finish a thing, you'll probably hate it. You'll know, like any sort of creative work, once you finish the piece of work, you know what you should have done in the first place, and you'll find you've gone a really long way around to achieve something that you now know how to do. But it's really important to remember, when you start, you don't know how to do it, and you don't, you know, how could you? So yeah, it's all about finding out how to do things and building up experience without doing too much and without making yourself feel. I'm so invested in talking about morale and being okay, almost. It's a tough business, making things. You know, it can be quite upsetting when it doesn't go to plan. So give yourself a break, you know, give yourself achievable goals, I think.
Yeah, like you also said that passion is very important at the beginning of the episode. And I always tell people, because I have seen in the last couple of months, because of what I now do on Twitter and on Discord servers, I have seen a lot of people with their simple projects, and also some coming to me with issues, and I'm having a writer's block, what can I do? And I'm always like, the first thing I can advise generally is, if you have passion for the project, you want to make it right, and that will make the project right. So the most important thing is passion for me, showing, having, loving this project you have, and then trying to develop the best thing you can do for that project is important, and also to take breaks, like you said, because I've seen a lot of people quickly burn out, and I have learned something in in a software engineer class I have at university that it's totally fine to take a break, a full day long break, rather than just working and then having to take a sick week because you have catched a cold or something because you just powered through and your body didn't handle it well. So rather take the one day off instead of a full week, because that sucks more after all.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's an important part of the process to be disciplined about. See, this is funny. My wife, if she hears this, will laugh her head off because I desperately need to take some time off. But I'm running a whole company. Do you know what I mean? You know, but individual projects. Yeah, having a break, walking away for a little bit, go and do something else, and then come back. Often solutions will present themselves purely by benefit of having taken a break. And you should just routinely do that and build that into your process, definitely. Because that initial flush of enthusiasm when you're full of ideas and the possibilities appear infinite, that energy is used up quite quickly, I think, or, you know, it will be used up at some point. And also the project becomes less, possibilities are narrowed down, and it becomes less sort of amazing or kind of, what am I trying to say? It's all very wonderful when you start out, because a project could be anything. I mean, when I'm making a painting, you know, before you put a mark on the page, the possibilities are infinite. But the more marks you put in, the less infinite those possibilities become, which can, you know, be quite upsetting, because you thought it was going to be one thing and it's turning into another thing. And yeah, breaks really help with that stuff, I think.
Regarding that thing you said in the beginning, that you planned to finish Beowulf within 6 months, but it took 2 years. How does it feel actually finishing Beowulf now after 2 years?
It's quite strange. I mean, really, really amazing to have completed the project, because it grew in scope. I think we thought we were just going to put out quite a small supplement that would do a few things. You know, that's like Dark Ages equipment list and some ideas of a sort of setting and not, you know, it had quite modest aims at the beginning. But the more we did, the more we realized we could do with it. You know, we did a lot more rules design than we thought we would do. And it grew and became its own thing. It's been absolutely amazing. Getting the print proofs was pretty emotional, that it's real. And I'm sure, hopefully this week, I will, if all goes well, I will actually hold a copy of the printed book in my hands. And I expect that will be quite an emotional thing, because there's a lot sort of tied up in it. You know, this is the first book we've produced for ourselves. We've done a couple of other books for other publishers. And obviously I have a long history of seeing my work in print and so on, but that never really gets tired. But this is our thing, you know. This is very much made by a select group of people, and it will be quite an emotional thing when it all comes together, I think. It's probably one of my favorite things, you know, is actually getting to hold a book in your hands. Is just amazing. It's quite a feeling.
Okay, so we have reached the end of our episode. Thank you definitely for being on with us and talking with us. We already more or less summarized what advice you gave, because passion is important for a project, doing something you can actually achieve, and also taking breaks. I feel like I sound like a broken record or something, because I say that nearly every day to someone. Take your breaks.
You're tougher for taking breaks than not taking breaks. It's the weak choice to not take breaks. It doesn't prove you're tough because you can't take a break. It proves you're like, you've got issues if you can't take a break.
I do too. I can throw that advice around to anyone, but I won't take it myself. So Are there any social medias, websites, and or persons you want to shout out before we end the episode?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you give us a follow at, well, check out our website, which is handiwork.games. Follow us on Twitter. We're at Games Handiwork. What else? We're on Facebook if you search Handiwork Games. We've got a YouTube channel. We do where you can find our podcast about Beowulf, where we're at the moment, me and Jacob are going through chapter by chapter, sort of giving you the director's cut and talking about our process, which you guys might find interesting. But yeah, get Handiwork Games is us, and you'll find us on the net with a search. Cool. Yeah, I think that's probably it.
Yeah, nice. So this brings us to the end. We are Double DM Pod on Twitter and Instagram. You can find us on any kind of podcasting platform you can think of outside in the web. And I think that's everything from us. So again, thanks, John, for being here with us and talking to us. And
thank you. Thank you. That's been great.
Thanks to all the people that listened, and we will see you guys in the next one.
Bye.
Have a good one. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.